The Robber Barons,
The House of Morgan, Part 2. Now, during the latest depression, which would have been 1893 to 1901, the House of Morgan, as a fighting organization, was complete in all of its parts and was ready for much of what it needed to do. In 1889, as 40 years later, in 1921, the House possessed a great amount of that goodwill, which is so vital to the investment banker in dealing confidently with his clients. It was known to hold literally to its contracts or deals with colleagues or accomplices. It impressed the legion of small investors, speculators, and dealers with its responsibility and integrity. Only the venerable, though much smaller firms of Lee, Higginson, Kidder, and Peabody in Boston, and the German Jewish group of Kuhn, Leb, in New York, approached Morgan in the quality of venerable probity towards its collaborators. So they really worked well with their people. To be armed at all points, to see all corners, to have eyes peering everywhere, Pierpont Morgan had surrounded himself with a group of lieutenants who were able, energetic, and often, as it happens, handsome as well. The standard of looks among the loyal young men was so high as to cause the remark that when the angels of God took unto themselves wives among the daughters of men, the result was Morgan's partners. In Wall Street, they spoke of Jesus Christ and his 12 apostles, though Morgan was an ugly, lowering figure, charged with vitality, curt, decisive, with rare moments of tears and passion, which only a few saw. The ablest of his partners were Charles H. Coster, the railroad expert, and Gisto Fabri, the Italian economist and mathematician, George W. Perkins, who came from the First National Bank, George S. Bowden, J. Hood Wright, and Robert Bacon, future ambassador to England, of impeccable appearance, but of lower tactical ability than the others. Coster was especially remarkable as a sort of financial chemist. He had joined forces with Drexel and Morgan in 1884, and ever since then had carried on all their elaborate railroad reorganizations. He is remembered as a white-faced, nervous man, hurrying from meeting to meeting, and in the evening carrying home his portfolios. A great master of detail, but of frail health. He was suddenly carried away by a slight cold, which quickly developed into pneumonia. Like the other Morgan partners, he had given all of himself to the immense tasks of economic organization with a courage and energy that might have been fruitful to the government or to society at large under another dispensation. All of Morgan's partners were rewarded with liberal shares in profit, toiled madly, and died young. By 1900, as Lewis Corey remarked, the first generation of them were all dead. Only Jupiter Morgan had come through that soul-crushing mill of business, retaining his vigor, health, and energy. There was a division of labor by which their work was departmentalized. One specialized in government finance, another in railroads, another in steel companies. They were all woven together, a broad network of relationships, and all reported back continually to the Supreme Commander for important decisions, whatever he might be. But the most impressive thing that could be perceived, if one looked deeply enough at all this mysterious labor, this heaving and shaking of worlds, was the progress of Morgan's ruling idea, an imperium imperio of banking under his supreme command. Inalterably, he continued to weld the new French banks, trusts, insurance companies, into whose control he penetrated, into a single concentrated financial structure, a solid pyramid at whose apex he sat. In this campaign of secret alliances, he acquired direct control of the National Bank of Commerce, then a part ownership in the First National Bank, allying himself with the very strong and conservative financier George F. Baker, who actually headed it. Then, by means of stock ownership and interlocking directories, he linked to the first name banks other leading banks, the Hanover, the Liberty, the Chase. Soon he had spread his control to the great insurance companies. In the largest of these, the New York Life, George W. Perkins was vice president, and at the same time a partner in the House of Morgan. In the case of the great Equity Life Assurance Society, Morgan was to pay $5,882 a share for control of that company. The three great life insurance companies, which Morgan dominated, the New York, the Equitable, and the Mutual, together owned approximately $1 billion of assets moving toward 1900. They must invest from $50 million to $55 million each year. Their management, Morgan or Perkins or Baker, would, as officials for trust and life insurance companies, buy securities from themselves as investment bankers, that is, as partners or lieutenants of the House of Morgan. What could be more perfect? Morgan and his general staff had not only got the ownership of the goose that lays the golden eggs, Mr. Brandeis concludes, but they also of the golden eggs laid by somebody else's goose. They control the people through the people's own money. As the Armstrong investigation in New York, which was directed by Charles Evans Hughes, and the later Pujo Committee investigation disclosed, Morgan directed a great pool of banks and insurance companies towards the purchase of securities which he floated. But then the proceeds of these securities must be deposited either directly into the House of Morgan or in his controlled banks, the First National, the Bank of Commerce, etc., which soon were to represent public deposits of $1.3 billion. Thus, the power of Morgan's associates was dynamic as opposed to the static wealth of landowners or merchants who actually possessed goods. The power and the growth of power of our financial oligarchies comes from welding the savings and quick capital of others. That's what Mr. Brandeis said. It bred a concentrated control over a vast portion of the nation's savings, which extended itself with absolutely amazing speed. From all his power to allot securities at will to the various institutions under his influence, it will be seen how much greater Morgan's domination was than his own personal wealth. He was in an admirable position, far more so than even men like Rockefeller and Carnegie, for all their huge direct income from industry in order to bring order. To end the condition, he referred to contemptuously as one thing one day and another thing another day. Now, the sources for this, and we have some more of Morgan to go. This, as you can tell, we're just barely touching the surface here. We have The Robber Barons by Matthew Josephson. We have The Age of Moguls, The Story of Robber Barons and Tycoons by Holbrook. And we also have America in the Gilded Age by Cashman. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com. Or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.